Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani and Zoe Grunewald on Fubar Radio.
Hello, you're listening to Politics Uncensored with me, Ali Milani.
And me, Zoe Grunewald.
Coming up, we'll discuss a remarkable survey by the Times newspaper this week that paints a demoralising picture of how Britain's young people view their country. Do Gen Z have a point to think the UK is not working for them? Or is it not that bad?
We'll also be speaking about Blue Labour, the idea dominating Westminster discourse this week, and whether Sir Keir Starmer can see off the challenge from Reform UK by embracing more socially conservative policies. But is the government taking the threat of Nigel Farage's party seriously enough?
As always, you can find us at Politics Uncensored UK on social media. All that and more coming up later in the programme.
But first, it's the Week Unwrapped.
How did you say that you'd worked at the Bank of England for a decade when, in fact, it was... Well, it wasn't even 6 years, it was five. I mean, that's exaggeration, isn't it?
Well, I worked at the Bank of England for 6 years, between 2000 and 2006. I was employed by the Bank of England, including I spent just over a year at the British Embassy working in the economics section.
So why did you say it was a decade?
Supporting the government and the bank.
Why did you say it was a decade?
Well, I think you're taking... I think it's one interview. I worked at the Bank of England for 6 years. I worked for then at Halifax Bank of Scotland, I think, for 3 years after that. I became an MP when I was 31. In the end, people want to judge me on the job that I'm doing today as Chancellor of the Exchequer. I'm qualified to do this job. But in the end, people are going to judge me. Am I growing the economy? Am I improving their living standards?
That's
and I'm determined
true.
To do just that.
That was Rachel Reeves speaking to ITV's GMB last month. It's now been confirmed her online CV did exaggerate how long she spent working at the Bank of England. The Chancellor left the financial institution 9 months earlier than she stated in her LinkedIn profile. This means she spent 5.5 years working at the bank, including nearly a year studying, despite publicly claiming to have spent a decade there. On the professional networking site LinkedIn, the Chancellor's profile claims she worked at the Bank of England from September 2000 to December 2006. But according to an investigation by the BBC, she had left by March 2006, where she began working for Halifax Bank of Scotland in West Yorkshire. A spokesman for Reeves confirmed that dates on her LinkedIn were inaccurate and said it was due to an administrative error by the team. They said the Chancellor hadn't seen it before it was published. Ali, there's been obviously quite a lot of back and forth about this for some time, but now it seems that the Chancellor did lie about her credentials before she became Chancellor. How much of a problem is this?
It's a significant problem in that I think... So initially there were questions about whether she had bloated her CV to get the... or as part of her sort of brand of becoming Chancellor. And then there were questions about whether she outright lied about her position. This comes in the context of she's had to apologise for a book, I think, that she'd written, where some of it, the pieces had been linked to, had been lifted from Wikipedia. So there's been a question around Rachel Reeves and her honesty for a little while. But at the time, there were a lot of people that said, it's not that big of a deal. Well, the question is, did she work there for 6 years or did she work there for 10 years? The bigger question was she an economist or was she working in the complaints department? So there's been questions around her honesty for a little while. This new story by BBC, I think, is quite significant because the question is no longer about dates and how long she worked there or even necessarily the job that she had, but there were serious questions around her use of company money. And so the BBC report suggests that there were concerns that were raised that three managers, of which Rachel Reeves was one, were using the bank's money to fund a lifestyle. With allegedly inappropriate spending on dinners, events, taxis and gifts, including for each other. And I think this is potentially a huge problem for Rachel Reeves, largely because the expenses scandal with politicians isn't that far off of the memory of the general public. And it's often one of the big complaints about politicians that's used. And so... this, alongside the fact that she was supposedly sacked from a previous job, which is also in the BBC's piece that I think people should read. It's a long form piece, so people should have a look at. I think causes significant problems for Rachel Reeves, because now it almost becomes either death by a thousand cuts or death by a single sort of big scandal on around expenses, because we've got the questions around her honesty with her book, lifting it out of Wikipedia, the question about her honesty about how long she worked at the Bank of England, the question about her honesty with whether she was an economist or worked for the complaints department, and now a serious investigation that was done while she was there around expenses, using bank money to fund lifestyles, spending things on like dinners, events, taxis and gifts for other managers, I think is a serious problem. Do you think this could hurt her, or can she ride it out?
I think the reason this is going to hurt her is because we've already seen a bit of this from Labour, right? So this is kind of reminiscent, as you say, of the expenses scandal. This is kind of reminiscent of the freebies scandal. And obviously Labour's economic plans and Rachel Reeves' budget particularly has come under a lot of scrutiny, which makes her a very easy target. Now, so the claim about her expenses, I personally think that it is feasible that a mistake could have been made on her LinkedIn about what exactly month she left somewhere. And
yeah,
you know,
we previously talked about 6-10 years. To be honest, if she had worked at the Bank of England for 6 years, that's still an impressive amount of time.
So I'm not, I personally am not too bothered by that.
The expenses stuff
is more interesting to me. So this former employee of hers said she nearly got sacked due to an expenses scandal where there were three managers all signing off each other's expenses. But this was 15 years ago that this apparently occurred, perhaps even more than that. And you just wonder how squeaky clean, you know, her other former chancellors have been, or other people who have come from this kind of background. I mean, I've never worked in that kind of banking environment, but I just always have had a sense that people behave like that. I'm not justifying it, but
I've never worked in a bank, but I did work for a big company that did have, we had a company credit card. And so what the BBC, and I'm quoting straight from the BBC here, is that she used things, the card, they call it motivation card, which is strange, but that they used the cards to buy birthday presents for colleagues. They used it for wine and cosmetics. Apparently she spent £152 on handbags and perfume.
It's not great, is it?
That when I worked at the company that I worked at, we would have been pulled up in front of the director of finance, which you never wanted to do, because no director of finance ever has any people skills with her.
It just again contributes to that sort of perception of politicians is just thinking they're above the rules.
Yeah.
I mean, and you know, this, the other thing
which
is,
which hurts Labour specifically because it was such an attack line they used in the tweet.
Remember Louise Hague, the former transport minister, resigned after it was found out that she had a spent conviction.
Yeah.
You know, decades ago, where she had reported her phone as stolen and then later found it and you know, she says forgot to inform the police, and she had a spent fraud charge. She got the lowest level of conviction you can get, and she served her time, and the Labour cabinet were aware, but she resigned. She was was forced out of the role.
Yeah.
Do you think there's a slight double standards here?
Definitely. I think, look, the one thing you could say about this current iteration of the Labour Party is there's not fairness in process on anything. You know, the closer you are to the faction and the leader, you're dealt with differently. There's no question about that. Anyone who denies that is a bold-faced liar. So there's no question that if I'm Louise Hague, I'm going, hang on a minute.
Yeah. What's different?
Can I ask you one question? I know we're running out of time. Rumours of reshuffle in Westminster, and that there's going to be a reshuffle in the spring. Do you think this is enough to
move Rachel?
To move her, considering she's getting flack from all sides.
So let me ask you quickly, who would replace her?
If I was to guess who would take that job, I don't know.
Pat McFadden?
Pat McFadden. Yeah. I think that's a good one. That's the most likely one.
Okay.
I think quite a lot are at risk. I think Lisa Nandy's at risk. I think David Lammy's at risk.
Yeah.
So there's quite a lot of risk. But actually, yes, if I was to put money on it, I think you're right. It'll be Pat McFadden if Rachel Reeves moves, which I don't think she will.
Let's watch this space. Okay, continuing with Labour. The fallout from a WhatsApp scandal, which has seen Sir Keir Starmer suspend two of his Labour MPs, is continuing to grow, with journalists continuing to pore over the thousands of messages sent in a group of party members. As well as former Health Minister Andrew Gwynne and Burnley MP Oliver Ryan, Labour has suspended 11 councillors, including Mr Gwynne's wife, Alison Gwynne, as investigating the full extent of the scandal. The MPs have faced calls to resign and forced by-elections over their involvement in the WhatsApp group, which reportedly contained racist, sexist and homophobic language, with fresh messages continuing to emerge. Ali, what does this say to you about the culture of the Labour Party?
So, first of all, the comments are really, really quite harsh.
They're terrible.
Yeah, I to be honest, like, so here's my position, right?
I mean, there's no defending any of them.
So my position on this, look, is... If we started to suspend MPs for what they said in private WhatsApp groups, 650 do we have MPs? Mm-hmm. A few less because some of the Irish ones don't sit.
Yeah.
650 odd MPs wouldn't have jobs if we were to hold them to the standard of public office as we do in their private WhatsApp groups. So we have to be a little bit careful about that. That being said, the comments are horrific, including... I think either calling for or insinuating the death of residents, elderly residents, I think.
Said that they hoped a constituent would be mowed down by a truck.
Yeah, this is...
72-year-old.
I tell you what, let's be honest for a second. I'm in loads of Labour WhatsApp groups where often there are jokes that push the line, but I've never seen anything like that.
The thing I find particularly interesting about this group, right, is... they bash Angela Rayner in it.
Yeah, I've just seen that, actually.
They bash Marsha Dakodova.
Yeah.
And they bash Diane Abbott.
What do those three people have in common?
Well, they're all women.
Yeah.
They're all...
Two of them are black women.
Two of them are black women. Mm-hmm. And am I right in thinking they're all more towards the left of the party? You can
they
correct
are.
Me on Marsha
yes.
if I'm wrong. Okay. Yeah, yeah. This, to me, is just... I don't want to say it's typical of Labour, but it is.
No, it is typical.
Yeah.
Do we not
the
remember
factionalism
the factionalism
and the misogyny of the Labour Party?
The Ford Report had some horrific things said about Diane Abbott by senior members of the Labour Party. And it was kind of just jumped over by a lot of the mainstream press. So what I want people to know is if you're reading some of these messages and the way that people are speaking about, consistent with the Ford Report, I have been inside the machinations of the Labour Party for 10 years now. This is exactly what it's like. Mm. In fact, it's worse. This is how people talk about people from different factions. This is how people are treated in the Labour Party. This isn't an outlier with Andrew Gwynn. This is the norm of the Labour Party.
So I want to ask you, do you think Labour has a problem with a boys' club as well? And do you think particularly right now? Because all the kind of stuff... You know, take it right back to when Sue Gray was the first person to resign from the Labour government, and allegations of a boy club, which people in Labour were quite quick to shut down. And then you see just the kind of sort of regular kind of victimisation of Angela Rayner, and the fact that Lou Hague had to resign, and then, you know, suggestions that Lisa Nandy could be on the chopping block. It always feels to me like, more often than not, it's the women in the Labour Party
who get...
victimized.
Yeah, I had a lunch about 8 months ago, right after we got Labour got into government. I think it was around August, September, where I was talking to some of the women. Just happened to have a lunch with some colleagues and friends who work very senior, both in the parliamentary side of Labour and the party side, if you will. And some of the stories I heard were really, really quite stark about the way women are treated, some of the things that are openly said in the offices, the double standards. So if your question is, does Labour have a boys club? It absolutely does. The way some women are treated in the party, and they won't say it out loud for fear of losing their jobs and not holding influence in the future, but I've heard it firsthand from them about the experiences they have. 100% true. Labour has, I think, a sexism problem within the structures. I think Labour has a racism problem within the structures. But the biggest problem Labour has is it won't talk about it.
Because it wants to be seen as better, holier than...
Well, it is, isn't it? I mean, how often do you hear people say Labour is the anti-racist party? Labour is the party of women and all
well,
that
we'll be
stuff.
We'll be talking about
what?
All that a bit more later on, because
bollocks.
When we talk about blue Labour, but...
Oh, Christ.
Before we get to that, let's talk about the Ukraine war. News... in Munich, where the annual Munich Security Conference is due to get going tomorrow, the continuing conflict in Ukraine is, of course, the key talking point.
We are at, as you said, Mr. Secretary, a critical moment. As the war approaches its third anniversary, our message is clear. The bloodshed must stop, and this war must end. President Trump has been clear with the American people and with many of your leaders that stopping the fighting and reaching an enduring peace is a top priority. He intends to end this war by diplomacy and bringing both Russia and Ukraine to the table. And the U.S. Department of Defense will help achieve this goal. We will only end this devastating war and establish a durable peace by coupling allied strength with a realistic assessment of the battlefield. We want, like you, a sovereign and prosperous Ukraine. But we must start by recognizing that returning to Ukraine's pre-2014 borders is an unrealistic objective.
That was US Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth speaking there. Well, Donald Trump has said he had a, quote, lengthy and highly productive phone call with Russian President Vladimir Putin yesterday, in which the leaders agreed to begin negotiations to end the war in Ukraine. In a post on his Truth Social platform, Trump said he and the Russian president have agreed to have our respective teams start negotiations immediately. The president did not set a date for a face-to-face meeting with Putin, but later told reporters at the White House, will meet in Saudi Arabia. Later, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said he had spoken with Trump about a lasting, reliable peace. The calls with the warring sides came as both Trump and his defense secretary said it was unlikely that Ukraine would join NATO, which will come as a bitter disappointment to Kiev. Trump also told reporters that it was unlikely Ukraine would return to its pre-2014 borders, but that some of the land will come back. Ali, the UK has just signed a 100-year defence partnership with Ukraine. But is the West really about to turn their backs on the Ukrainians?
Well, yeah, it depends on who we call the West, if the West is Donald Trump. Yes, you know what I found interesting about this? Is Donald Trump is supposedly entering into lengthy and productive discussions with the president of Russia, Vladimir Putin, to end the war in Ukraine.
Mm.
So the president of the United States is negotiating with the president of Russia to end a war in another country in Ukraine.
Mm.
The people who have the absolute right to negotiate on Ukraine are the Ukrainian people.
Yeah.
It's a sovereign country and a sovereign people whose land is being negotiated away by a president thousands of miles away. And do you know what I thought was most offensive about this, if I'm a Ukrainian, is he called Putin before he called Zelensky.
Mm.
And I think Zelensky's spoken about that today, that he didn't speak to the president of Ukraine, which is a key ally that America has been funding for since the war started. And he spoke to Putin before he spoke to Zelensky.
The thing about Donald Trump is, before the election, everyone thought this man is an isolationist.
Well, right? It's changed, doesn't it?
Well, this is what I'm going to say.
Yeah.
So he was seen as an isolationist. Now he is nothing short of a naked imperialist. The way he's talking about Gaza, the way he's spoken about Greenland, Canada, Mexico,
Panama,
and now Ukraine. He sees himself as the almighty doer and seer of everything that goes on in the world. What America says goes. He feels absolutely empowered to not only meddle in the affairs of other countries, but actually call the shots.
Yeah.
I think he is an incredible, I think this is an incredibly dangerous.
You know what the problem is? I think this time it's not sort of isolationist right wing Donald Trump. We've got property
it's
developer.
Expansionist.
It's
oh,
property 100%. Developer
yeah.
Donald Trump.
Yeah.
He's acting like a rogue sort of property
yeah.
developer, renter, buyer, but just with the arms of the world's most powerful country.
You know, imperialism used to be couched in faux moral terms. So it used to be that we're going to go and colonise this country because we're going to bring Western civilization. You know, it was this
kind of... Britain said about India. We're going to...
Exactly.
We've built them the railroads.
It was the civilising mission.
Yeah, yeah.
This is just naked expansionism. This is, I'm going because I can profit financially from doing this and I don't give a... fuck
well, look,
what you guys do.
Well, look the way he's talking about Greenland and Gaza specifically. We're going to buy it.
Yeah.
And we're going to make it the Riviera. We're going to build these things. And it's almost like what we used to get at when I was the president of the student union. We'd have these private accommodation companies come on campus with all these fancy brochures about we're going to build this, we're going to build it. It's exactly the way he's talking. The problem is he's not a property developer. He's the president of the United States.
Absolutely. Okie doke. Plenty to talk about. That is The Week Unwrapped. Coming up, a remarkable survey this week paints a demoralising picture of how Britain's young people view their country. Do Gen Z have a point to think the UK is not working for them, or is it not all that bad? That's next on Politics Uncensored.
Fubar Radio. That Money Show with Gabriel Nussbaum on FUBAR Radio.
I am joined now by Ricardo Mighty. He is the CEO of Mighty Labs.
I just think if you're going to get into crypto, you just can't think short term. If you're trying to, I don't know, like pay your bills next month and you think I'm going to invest in crypto this month and then I'm going to take the gains out and do something with, you just can't think like that, because 99.9% of the time, the market doesn't work the way you want it to work. It works how it's going to work. The longer you have your investment in crypto, most likely the better it will do.
You're listening to FUBAR Radio. Download our app now to listen to your favourite shows, such as Access All Areas, Politics Uncensored, and The Dating Show. You can also download and catch up on previous episodes of all FUBAR shows, including our box sets. Plus, you can get in touch directly from within the app.
Just search for FUBAR Radio on the Apple and Google app stores.
Yay! The FUBAR Radio app. Get it today.
Get it today.
It was calm on the beach, so I took my little girl out on the water. Then we hit the wind, and it blew us out to sea, faster than we could paddle back. And we learned our lesson from these guys, the crew who got us home. Thank you.
Respect the water and watch out for the winds. In an emergency, call 999 and ask for the Coast Guard.
Registering to vote means you can take part in the way decisions are made in the UK. When you register to vote, you are then able to cast your vote at local and national elections. You can help choose who runs your area and makes decisions about things you care about. Millions of people in the UK aren't registered to vote, and they miss out on having their voice heard. It's quick and easy to register. It only takes 5 minutes. You can do it online, or you can ask for a paper form at your local council. Register to vote now at gov.uk/register to vote.
What the hell with Gabby Allen.
Mr. Later Williams, hello. Mate, can we just address that you did Strictly Come Dancing?
I know, people were quite upset about that, to be fair. But listen, not the first musical theatre performer to be on Strictly. Won't be the last. I've never watched a full season from the start to the end. So when it actually got to it, I was like, whoa, like there's so many different styles. I was like, oh, and Nikita, I love him, but he was really pushing me to be the best that I could be.
Access All Areas with Bobby Norris.
And we've got Miss Chloe Brockett in the studio.
It got to the point where I wasn't enjoying it as much as I used to. I used to love it. You know, it was my life. I wasn't in relationships because I was going on TOWIE. I wasn't, you know, invested in anything other than the show because I loved it so much. And then as I got older, I just didn't enjoy it anymore. I noticed that the cast around me had changed. All the OGs had gone and I'd all of a sudden become an OG at 23. And was a bit like, you know what, I don't think this is for me anymore.
Follow us at Politics Uncensored UK for more from the show.
You're listening to Politics Uncensored with me, Ali Milani.
And me, Zoe Grunewald. Now, a comprehensive new study into Britain's young people, Gen Z, has painted a demoralising picture of how they view their country. Here are some takeaways from the Times newspaper's 2024 Gen Z survey. Only 41% of young people today were proud to be British, and just 15% believed the country was united. Only 11% would fight for Britain, and 41% said there were no circumstances in which they would take up arms for their country. 50% believed that the UK was stuck in the past. Almost two-thirds believed that marriage was still an important institution, and a third thought it was better for a couple to be married before having children. Only 23% said their friends commonly had sex on a one-night stand, down from 78% of millennials who answered this 20 years ago. More than half, 56%, said transgender women should be allowed to use women's toilets. 28% disagreed. Only 26% said that transgender women should be allowed to take part in women's sporting events. 49% were opposed. 21% said they did not drink alcohol, and only 17% drink several times a week. 60% said they had never tried a cigarette or vaped, but 64% supported decriminalising cannabis. Almost a third of 18 to 27-year-olds had sought mental health help in the past 3 years. 30% had debts of £10,000 or more. Wow. That's big. 24% of men and 44% of women said they had suffered from mental health issues. The Times conducted a similar survey 20 years ago, and by most metrics, the country is viewed in a worse light now by Britain's young people than it was back in 2004. Ali, there's so much to unpick there. The debt thing really stuck out to me, but then I thought about probably some of that's got to do with student loans. Still an extraordinary amount of debt, money for young people to owe. What here really stands out for you, and what do you read into it?
The thing that stands out for me is that I'm not surprised by any of it. And the reality
is... So nothing stands out to you?
Well... No, it stands out in that I think it reinforces entirely what I have thought in my own experience. Look, I'm not 18, was it 18 to 24? I've aged out of that, unfortunately. So I guess I'm not young anymore. But I'm of the same sort of generation. And I think if the question is, why don't young Britons identify with Britain as much? Why won't they fight for Britain as much? Why do they have such a negative view on Britain? The answer to that question is, what the fuck do you want them to identify with? Because this generation has been battered again and again and been told by a country that, and the country's leaders, that you're lazy, you're woke, you're poor, you don't go to work, you work from home, you believe in all these crazy stuff, you don't fight for this country, you're too soft, you don't have resilience. And then they throw up their arms in complete shock that they don't identify with this country anymore. The reality is young people in this country think British and identifying with Britain and that sort of patriotism is these pound shop Enoch Powell, Rupert Lowe sort of far-right extremists in Parliament who have colonised what being British is in the sort of public discourse, draped themselves in the flag, and are now shocked that more than half of young people don't identify with Britain. What do you want them to identify with? The fact that they've been handed a poorer economy than their parents had, the fact that they've been handed thousands of pounds of educational debt, the fact that they have to pay double for water now, the fact that they have to pay double for electricity and gas, that workplace laws are as bad as they've been for a long time, the economic outlook is as poor as it has ever been, they watch their country fund and arm genocides all across the world, that knife crime is through the roof in this country, and that while all of this is happening, they're being called woke, they're being called weak, they're being called soft snowflakes. And then you're surprised that they don't identify with the country? So, what the fuck are they going to identify with?
So I do agree with you, and I think probably the state of the economy is the biggest factor in this. You know, the fact that 78% of privately held housing wealth is owned by people who are 50 and older in this country. You know, there's a vast disparity of property ownership between young and older people. And, you know, this we see this across Europe, right, as well. But I also wonder if there's just a sense that war, there's so much conflict in the world right now. When you're asking young people, would you fight for Britain? I think people say, I don't want to fight. I think there is a generation of young people who do not see war as leading to better things. Yeah. They see... They learn in their history lessons that war has never really bred peace.
Yeah.
And even if there is peace, it's only for a period of time before everything starts to crumble again. And even in Europe, we're seeing that now. You know, we are beating off the far right once again in Europe. So I wonder if there is just this sense of they're sick of the kind of relentlessness of conflict as well.
Yeah, do you know, I've had this idea for a really long time. You know, historically, politically, the biggest gaps in voting patterns and political ideology has been class. I think that's changed entirely now. I think the gap is age now. I think there is a gulf between the way that young and sort of youngish people, so 18 to 35, look at the world and the way that I think sort of 40 to 60 year olds look at the world.
And you know why? Because we know that class used to be, it was a socioeconomic thing. Yeah. It was incredibly tied to your assets and your wealth in many ways, and that distinguished class. And what has happened is we had sort of modern democratic capitalism that was supposed to make wealth accessible to everyone through a meritocracy. But all actually that happened was it just allowed capitalism on steroids, where business owners and really wealthy people could hoard their wealth through capitalism. So they could basically buy a house, let the price of housing go up because no other housing was being built. And now what you have is a really unequal system where young people in this country earn far less than pensioners. Yeah. You know, it used to be that pensioner poverty was a massive thing in this country. And, you know, obviously we still have pensioners who are in poverty. But you're way more likely to be a millionaire than you are to be in poverty as a pensioner. Whereas now, younger generations, they can't get on the housing ladder, as you say. Their wages have stagnated, still living at home with their parents. I mean, when you look at stuff like, they're not having one night stands anymore, they're not going out anymore, they're not drinking anymore, they're not smoking cigarettes. I mean, I just think, well, it's quite hard to do all that if you live in an incredibly crowded house share or you live with your parents at home still because you can't afford to move out and get your own place.
Yeah, and look, so one of the things that stood out to me on this was that 56% said transgender women should be allowed to use the women's toilets. If you actually look at the cultural debate that's happening in our political system right now, you would assume 95% of people are utterly outraged that a transgender woman would use the women's toilets. And so no matter what you think on this particular position, it's clear that there is a disassociation or a break between what the political class are talking about and what young people
feel,
actually believe. Let's use me and your real life lived experience as an example, right? You're a few years younger than me, even though you know I look about 15 years older than you. It's not that much of a difference.
No, don't say that.
When we graduated, we were amongst the first to be charged for university. We had our educational maintenance allowance gotten rid of. The generation right before me got paid to go to college. They got a £30 a week allowance. That was gone. We had austerity imposed on our generation for the first time. Homelessness went up. Disabilities were cut. The economy went through three different recessions during our lifetime. Our prospects of owning property in our lifetime massively reduced.
Also, job wages have stagnated
job
since 2007.
Have stagnated, but also conditions within jobs have stagnated. Brexit happened as we entered the job market, and we had the COVID-19 pandemic. What the fuck do they want from us? Do you know what I mean? Like, and when people like Nigel Farage say it's the educational system that are broken, that people don't identify because this woke culture, and you know, crazy idiots like Elon Musk stand in the Oval Office and talk about the woke mind virus. No, you absolute imbeciles.
Yeah.
The reality is you have battered a generation beyond its ability to be able to identify with the country that they live in. And then you're shocked that only 11% would fight for Britain and only 41% are proud to be British. I go back to, what do you want them to be proud of when you've hit them over the head their entire life?
So I want to talk about this. I want to talk about Nigel Farage's comments, because he said that this was all the result of the broken education system. He said, "I think the education system is willfully poisoning the minds of all our young people about who we are as a country, our history, what we stand for. The whole thing is a disgrace." This is an absolute mark of authoritarianism. Rather than blaming the system, which is, as we've just discussed, for all the reasons, the economy is broken, capitalism is broken, it is not making people better off generation after generation, it is locking young people out of it. You go after young people's minds. You say, "I'm going to change what you think. I'm going to make you like it." And Reform UK have in their contract or whatever it is, plans to change the education system to instill national pride in it, whatever that means. Do you know who else did that? That happened in Nazi Germany. That's happening in Viktor Orban's Hungary. It's happening in Marine Le Pen's France. That is a classic hallmark of the far right. If people think Nigel Farage is this radical disruptor who is going to change their fortunes and make this country better, why has he not seized on this and said, "The system is broken. What we're going to do is make housing more affordable. We're going to make the economy more affordable. We're going to bring wages up." He would rather change people's ability to access education than actually change the system. He is not. He wants the status quo. Wants rich people to get richer.
And Nigel Farage is the most establishment status quo politician that we have in Westminster, who just dresses like an anti-establishment figure. Let's not forget, this is the man who worked in the City of London and worked amongst and within all of these multi-billion pound bankers who took all of us for a ride in 2008. And they have one playbook. They have one quiver in their arrow. When everything goes to shit, blame the immigrants. And when that doesn't work with 18 to 24 year olds, because they've grown up in diverse communities, because they're actually, I think, this younger generation, the most ethically conscious generation we have ever had, they see Britain, whether right or wrong, I disagree with it. I actually think that the left should take back some level of proudness of your country and community more than anything. When they associate Britain and the flag with these, I'll call them again, pound shop Enoch Powells who drape themselves in the flag, and these establishment status quo stooges who just think that by putting 64 flags behind them, they're somehow British patriots. When people see through that, the only thing they've got to go back to is we have to re-educate their minds, which is the most dangerous form of... I saw it in Iran. Part of the reason my family fled that country. But I'm actually quite hopeful about this, because I think the younger generation completely see through these bogus politicians, and are very tuned in to what's going on around the world. If I was the political establishment, the sort of, and mostly on the right, Farage, Rupert Lowe, I'm not going to include Lee Anderson because I don't think independent thought often enters his head, but people like Badenoch and others, I would shit myself over this, because this is a trend to which my political party doesn't see power for generations. If this continues, and if they're not able to present a positive narrative, if I'm the Labour Party or anyone on the centre left, this is a massive opportunity. This is a generation that's begging the political system to provide them with some hope, some opportunity, something to believe in. But what, they're going to be let down like we always do.
Well,
and what's the Labour Party done, which we're going to move into next? It's fucking pivoting
to join reform on the benches. Yeah. Well, coming up, we will talk about all of that. What is Blue Labour and why is it making waves in the news this week? They say Labour has to change to counter Reform UK's surge in the polls. But is that true, or does the Labour Party risk unnecessarily tearing itself apart? All that and more next.
It's Ali Milani and Zoe Grunewald with Politics Uncensored. FUBAR Radio. FUBAR Radio. That Money Show with Gabriel Nussbaum on FUBAR Radio.
I am joined now by Ricardo Mighty. He is the CEO of Mighty Labs.
I just think if you're going to get into crypto, you just can't think short term. If you're trying to, I don't know, like pay your bills next month and you think I'm going to invest in crypto this month and then I'm going to take the gains out and do something with, you just can't think like that, because 99.9% of the time, the market doesn't work the way you want it to work. It works how it's going to work. The longer you have your investment in crypto, most likely the better it will do.
You're listening to FUBAR Radio.
Download our app now to listen to your favourite shows, such as Access All Areas, Politics Uncensored, and The Dating Show. You can also download and catch up on previous episodes of all FUBAR shows, including our box sets. Plus, you can get in touch directly from within the app.
Just search for FUBAR Radio on the Apple and Google app stores.
Yay! The FUBAR Radio app. Get it today.
Get it today.
Is the sound of your mates alive? Is getting to more gigs this year and the next? Is the sound of saying, I got you, mate? Is the sound of mates enjoying even more of this? Is the sound of mates getting home instead of here? Click your seatbelt, because you're twice as likely to be killed or seriously injured if you don't think.
When you notice something wrong, it tends to grow and eventually take over, to the point you can't really think of anything else. If something in your body doesn't feel right, the thought it could be cancer can play on your mind. Tests could put your mind at rest. Finding out sooner is always better. Your NHS wants to see you. Contact your GP practice.
What the hell with Gabby Allen.
Mr. Later Williams, hello. Mate, can we just address that? You did Strictly Come Dancing.
I know, people were quite upset about that, to be fair. But listen, not the first musical theatre performer to be on Strictly. It won't be the last. I've never watched a full season from the start to the end. So when it actually got 2 hours, I was like, whoa, like there's so many different styles. I was like, oh. And Nikita, I love him, but he was really pushing me to be the best that I could be.
Access All Areas with Bobby Norris.
We've got Miss Chloe Brockett in the studio.
It got to the point where I wasn't enjoying it as much as I used to. I used to love it. You know, it was my life. I wasn't in relationships because I was going on TOWIE. I wasn't, you know, invested in anything other than the show because I loved it so much. And then as I got older, I just didn't enjoy it anymore. I noticed that the cast around me had changed. All the OGs had gone and I'd all of a sudden become an OG at 23. And was a bit like, you know what, I don't think this is for me anymore.
Follow us at Politics Uncensored UK for more from the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to Politics Uncensored with me, Ali Milani.
And me, Zoe Grunewald. Okay, Blue Labour. Just what is that? Well, the idea dominating Westminster discourse this week is whether Sir Keir Starmer can see off the challenge from UK by embracing Blue Labour. Blue Labour, you might think, will be totally different from what Reform UK is offering, because how are you going to fight Reform UK on their own grounds? Well, you're completely wrong. It combines left-wing economics, which, to be fair, Reform doesn't have, with something called social conservatism. These practitioners of the ideology consider the blue in Blue Labour to stand for blue collar. Also possibly sad labour, I've heard that as well, which is a shorthand for the skilled working class. They consider those voters the most fought over cohort in the British electorate and the ones the government should be trying to woo. They argue these voters are the most likely to return from Reform. And there is evidence to support this. According to a recent constituency-by-constituency polling model, Reform would win 76 seats if an election were held now. Of course, 60 would be won from Labour, including seats across the prized Red Wall, as well as in Wales and the south of England. However, the analysis also reveals that even a relatively small further swing towards Reform could see Labour could see the party pick up another 76 Labour-held seats. And it's this that has forced senior figures in the Labour Party to begin privately talking about turning into Reform UK. Oh, sorry, I misread that. About a change of era to prevent more moderate voters from turning to Nigel Farage's party. Ali, I bet you're a big fan of Blue Labour, aren't you?
There isn't a brick wall hard enough for me to bang my head against.
Okay, I'll throw somebody into it.
Well, to throw somebody into it. Do you remember, was it last week or a couple of weeks ago, we were talking about immigration and we said Labour has two options, right? To present a new vision or to pivot and try and essentially play the game on Reform's grounds. And we speculated that we thought that they would go to fighting the battle on Reform's ground. And lo and behold, here we are. This is ethically wrong, morally outrageous, but politically idiotic.
Yeah, nice.
Which, Jake, am I looking into this camera? Right, if you're Blue Labour, there is no world in which you out-reform Reform. I am begging you from the studios of FUPAR Radio, cut it out. You're not going to be able to out-racist Nigel fucking Farage. Give it up. First of all, Dan Cardin. What are you doing? Dan Cardin is not, from what my experience is, a sort of right-winger. I think the vision is sort of economically left, socially right. Right. So all of my emotional stuff to one side. From a political perspective, the public are never going to accept a light version of something over true authenticity of something else, right? So Labour's attempt to say we have deported more people than Reform ever will, or we're going to lurch to the right, or even putting out Reform light sort of material, has never worked for anyone. Case in point, the Conservatives at the last election. They tried to distance themselves from their own leader, or they tried to put out material in green colours, for example, and in light blue, like Reform. This never works. This is number one strategy for political suicide, to handing over waves of red seats to the light blue of 50p Lee, and it's going to end in utter disaster.
So let me ask you this. We know that where the country falls, you and I are progressives of the left, but also socially progressive, I would say, right? But we know that most people in this country, or where voters tend to broadly fall in their kind of majority, is fairly statist. So they're fairly economically left-wing, as in they like public services and they like the idea of people having welfare if they need it. But they are fairly socially conservative right-wing. Not hugely. You know, they tend to be fairly progressive, especially compared to some other countries in the world. But they're quite big on law and order. But the British public like when government bans things, for example. And we're not that pro-immigration as a nation. And we're not, you know, we like long prison sentences. And if you asked most people, they'd probably say bring back the death penalty.
Yeah, I think so, it's like 52% in favor.
So we might not like this. And I'm just posing this question because it's worth asking. We might not like it. But if the public like it, then perhaps we should get on board.
No, so do you know, okay, let's remove our political ideology for a second and think about this as a journalist who works in political news every single day, speak to voters as well as speaking to politician, and as a politician slash political sort of hack
thinker
who does, by the way, on a day-to-day basis, media and comms work for political organizations, there is no route to victory here, because while you might be right in terms of analyzing the voter base, there are two things that's missing in that analysis. One is the moment that we're in, and two is actually voters tend to vote on emotion, and they tend to vote value more than anything authenticity. If you actually look at the 2017 election, one of the things that Jeremy Corbyn got right is a vast majority of voters said, I might not even agree with everything he says, but I think he believes in it, and I like that he says what he thinks and he does it. Right? Trump is the same thing. There are two problems with Blue Labour. One, right-wing voters don't believe you. They think Labour is lying, right? They think they're just putting on this cloak to win their vote.
The socially conservative cloak, yeah.
And two, if I want to deport more people, if I want to stop all these immigrants coming to this country, if I want to see the country go back to what it was in the 40s and 50s, I'm never ever going to vote for the light version of that when I can have the pure thing. Ed Miliband learned that when he tried austerity light, right? When and if anyone in that cabinet should be raising alarm bells, it should be Ed Miliband. Because he learned better than anyone that if you allow your opponent, and it's politics 101, so if you're listening and you're not like us, political hacks are involved in it, let me give you some free training that I usually charge people for, right? The number one rule of political communications is do not let your opponent define the debate, right? You set the grounds of the debate. So in the same way that if I'm going to play a football match against another opponent, I don't let them set the rules of the football game. You don't let your opponent set the rules of the political debate because you will lose. Ed Miliband did that in 2010. He allowed the sort of the center of the political discussions in 2010 to be government has overspent, not 2010, sorry, 2015, that the reason that the economy crashed in 2008 was because of government overspending, it was Labour's fault, and we need austerity. That was the moment he lost the election. It wasn't a bacon sandwich. It wasn't anything in the manifesto. It wasn't the Edstone. It was the fact that he allowed the Tories to define the debate. And once they define the debate, they can beat you on experience.
Yeah.
They can beat you on authenticity. They can beat you on the fact that they have a more coherent, clear message and consistency over the years of saying it. That is exactly what Blue Labour is suggesting, that we allow not the Tories, but fucking Reform UK to set the political debate, to essentially draw the box in which we have the fight in, and Labour will lose 10 times out of 10 twice on Sunday.
So let me talk to you about Maurice Glassman, who is a Labour peer who has been in the news this week. He is seen as the father of Blue Labour. In this piece of the New Statesman, they say he's drawn on influences for Blue Labour, including Aristotelian philosophy, ethical socialism, Burkean conservatism and German industrial democracy. He is basically economically left-wing, as we've said, but pretty socially conservative, to the point where you actually might say he's pretty woke-bashing. I was shocked this week, Ali, to find out he has recently... He was the only Labour figure at Donald Trump's inauguration, for a start. He was on Steve Bannon's podcast, right, on Rumble.
Steve Bannon, man who went to prison. Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Steve Bannon, the crazy American podcast. So Bryce Breitbart, he went on his podcast. I listened to it before this show.
It is
crazy. You would not know this man is a Labour peer. He has the Labour whip in the House of Lords. One of the things he said, he called progressives, bear in mind, Labour Party calls itself a progressive party. He said they are the enemy. They actually despise faith. They despise family. They despise love. They don't even want you to enjoy sexual intercourse with your wife. They despise love, joy, truth, beauty. And they do all the time to undermine solidarity between the races in order to build proper working class solidarity. This is my transcription. So that bit might have been a bit fumbled at the end. But the stuff about progressives being the enemy, I think, is an extraordinary thing for a Labour peer to say, considering that most of your voter base are...
You said Labour don't want you to have sex with your wife.
Progressives don't want you to enjoy sexual intercourse with your wife. I'd love to see his workings for that.
This man has the Labour whip.
This man has the Labour whip.
I was born on the 19th of July, 1994, and for every day since, I have never been speechless. Today is the 11th or 13th of February, 2024.
It is.
And for the first time in my life, I'm speechless.
So what should... But this is worth pointing out, that he said Morgan McSweeney is one of ours. Not on this podcast, he said this in this interview in the news.
Morgan McSweeney is the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom.
The Prime Minister's political...
Oh, right, the political, not the Prime Minister.
Yes, he's,
that's Keir Starmer.
He's Keir Starmer's... Chief, very, see what he did there. Keir Starmer's chief of staff. Glassman says Morgan is one of ours. And recently, Keir Starmer has been parroting blue Labour lines. We've seen this in the immigration stuff. We've seen this a little bit in the grooming gang stuff. He says the working class have been ignored for too long, etc., etc.
You see that thing they put out, Labour, by the way? The images of people being deported from the plane.
Pretty blue Labour. Is this the future of the Labour Party?
I don't think it's the future of the Labour Party.
Well, and I don't mean...
Because I think it will fail.
But you think it will fail?
Of course it will, yeah. If this does not... If this strategy works, clip this again, 13th of February, I will come back on this show, I will shave my head live on air wearing a chicken costume. That's how confident I
am.
I can't think of
good.
Much. No, here's what. Here's worse. And my producer... If this works... Mm. I will go on any broadcast, FUBAR primarily, wearing a Liverpool Football Club shirt.
Oh my God, even I know that's bad.
That's how I am 100%. Because
let me ask you this, we're running out of time and I really want to get your thoughts on this.
I have questions for you as well.
How do they beat reform then?
You present an alternative vision. Mm-hmm. Here's how you beat reform. You say to the country, look, since 2008, this country has been taken for a ride by billionaires and the ultra rich. They crashed our economy through their corporate greed, everywhere from the CEO and the shareholders of Thames Water, who are ripping you off, to the big six energy companies who are increasing your energy bills while taking shareholder money and putting it in the Cayman Islands and in tax-free. Mm-hmm. They have been laughing at every working-class, working person in Britain since 2008 because they all got together in 2008 and they decided that their greed had crashed the economy and the only way out was to blame the immigrants. That the only way that they'd be able to get rid of the blame that rightly falls on their shoulders was to blame black and brown people next door who are stealing your jobs, who are taking your spots in the NHS, who are taking your children's spots in local schools. That was their strategy. And you say from this day forward, we reject that strategy and we are actually going after what has actually crashed our economy, according to every single expert, and that's corporate capitalist ultra greed. That doesn't mean we don't want people to do well. That doesn't mean we don't want people to be able to earn millions of pounds, but you're not going to be able to do it off the backs of working people through housing, through education, through health. We are going to tackle the cancer of our society, which is ultra capitalist greed. If you present that alternative vision, you win.
So do you think that Glassman has a point in this interview when he said Rachel Reeves seems to have forgotten entirely the conversation around securenomics and the everyday economy? Now she's just a drone for the Treasury. There's no vision of economic renewal and no idea about how to renew the faraway towns.
I think there's a point in terms of they don't have any idea of economic renewal.
I mean, a broken clock is right twice a day. But, yeah.
Can I ask you one question, though?
Yes.
I want to get your views on this. So Maurice Glassman can go on Breitbart or can go on Bannon's podcast and say all of these outrageous things, hold to the Labour whip, but there's no place for the Labour Party for John McDonnell, former Chancellor, for what? Voting for
the two-child
limit?
To be
what does that say about the Labour Party?
I think it sounds like there is blue Labour endemic, like a virus, inside the centre of the Labour Party.
The other question I want to ask you is, I mean, you often ask me what the noises are within the Labour circles, but within media and journalistic circles, I'm seeing a lot of the more liberal, sort of centre-left journalists starting to turn on Starmer. Ian Dunt, for example.
Ian Dunt, this week I saw, I think the immigration stuff is really...
And he's not a lefty, let me tell you that much for free.
So
I mean, he might be centre-left, but he's not...
I would say he's centre-left, but I know what you mean. I think there's two frustrations from broadly Labour-supporting commentariats, which is the first that it goes against their values to embrace this kind of woke bashing, anti-immigrant sentiment. Secondly, that we've seen time and time again, it doesn't work. We've had two failed Tory administrations in recent years trying to carve to the right. So it doesn't work. So I think there's two frustrations there. Also that we just thought Labour was going to be better than this.
And what a pipe dream that turned out to be.
Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani and Zoe Grunewald on Fubar Radio.
That's it from Politics Uncensored today. Join us next Thursday at 5 p.m. where we unwrap the week's political talking points. You can stay up to date with the show by following at Politics Uncensored UK on social media, where you can find me at Ali Milani UK. Please don't ask me why I'm still a member of the Labour Party.
And you can find me at Zoe Grunewald on Blue Sky and Instagram.
If you've missed any of today's show, you can listen back and catch up at FubarRadio.com or via the Fubar Radio app.
Download it from your app store now.
Thanks for listening. See you next week for another episode of Politics Uncensored.
It's Ali Milani and Zoe Grunewald with Politics Uncensored. Fubar Radio.